they do. Because if you go online, someone, and you'll find a website where someone says, what I say it means is the exact opposite. So, well, it's in stone. It's not in stone. I'm going to tell you, you know, kind of what I see and things like that. A lot of this is from my readings. A lot of this is just from observation. One of my part of my job responsibility is I spend a lot of time in cemeteries, and I just notice. And so a lot of this is what I notice. And I will tell you when I don't know why. It's like, I've just noticed this, and I don't know why, and I can't explain it. But so don't be surprised if you go to a website or a book, and they say it means something slightly different or something like that. Sometimes I think it also depends on where you're from, because the people on the East Coast have very different views of tombstones than Midwesterners do. The Association for Gravestone Studies, which is a national organization, they had their conference in Franklin, about 3 years ago. It was very interesting to see how they viewed our, you know, new tombstones, things like that. So it's a very different view. So just know that, you know, I'm gonna explain to you where and what I get, and so then you can take it and walk out of here and go, she's nuts, or she's brilliant, and I'm okay with either of those. So the first people who come to this country are Puritans. And they are, you know, they're most of their cemeteries are going to be church cemeteries. Puritans had a really deathly view of death. I mean, there it's going to get you, it's coming for you, it's, you know, it's sneaking up on you, kind of a thing. They also had a view that you were predestined. Before you were born, God knew whether you were going to heaven or not. So regardless of how you behaved as a human being your entire life, when you died, you were going to heaven or you're going to hell. It was predestined. So their view of death was really going to get you, kind of a thing. But it comes up on your tombstones, and so it's very, very cool on some of the things that you see. So you get this skull, the winged skull, and you get the hourglass. So it's a tempus fugit, so time flies, death's coming at you, it's going to get you. And then I love this one. So you've got the Grim Reaper coming to get you. You've got the skeleton, or the soul, the candle, which is the soul, and the life is being snuffed out. So again, they are just happy people. And our ancestors, who, whether they were Puritan in religion or not, this is what they were exposed to. And so then when they start coming west, they're bringing some of that with them. Now the first people who are coming to Indiana are not carvers. They are farmers. And so what they are carving into their stones, a lot of the early stuff is just some basic information. So your earliest stones aren't going to be that ornate. They're not going to be that artistic, because these guys weren't artistic. They were farmers, and they were concerned about getting the trees cut up off their ground so they could farm. But they're going to get some. You're going to get some very basic information. But if you notice the shape of this stone, does it not look very much like the shape of that? Because again, they're bringing that same thing with them. So what they saw back in New England area and on the coast, and as they're moving farther west, they're bringing those same ideas with them, because that's what they're used to when it comes to tombstones. Now they're using this material, it's called a wet stone, W-H-E-T, and most farmers used a wet stone to sharpen knives and the plows and things like that. And so they realized it's a soft stone, so it takes a carving very easily. So you don't have to be with like limestone where you have to chisel it in. This cuts it pretty easy. Holds it too. Holds that very nicely. Actually, these stand up better to the weather than limestone and marble do. So you can get some of these, and these will be from the 1820s and 1830s, and they are still as legible or more than the stones from the early 1900s. But so I love these stones. They're amazing. They're predominantly southern Indiana is where the stone was found and where you find them. So once we get settled, one of the first things we're going to set up with our churches or our religious groups are cemeteries. We are no more segregated than when we are dead. Because as a Catholic, I'm going to be in a Catholic cemetery, and there's not going to be a Methodist near me. And then the Methodists are going to be in their cemetery, and there's not going to be a Baptist near them. So we are in our religious cemeteries. This one is this Jewish cemetery just south of downtown Indianapolis. There's actually 9 Jewish cemeteries all right near each other, and they're very interesting. Now, I can obviously tell it's a Jewish cemetery because there's Hebrew on the stones, so I immediately noticed that. But some other things, we've got the Star of David, we've got the menorah, lion is a very popular symbol on there, and then this. It's called the Hands of Cohen. And I'm not Jewish and Catholic, and so I know nothing about Judaism. So I had a rabbi taking me through the cemetery, telling me what she sees and what she notices. And the Hands of Cohen are for people who can prove ancestry to Abraham. It is special, it is rare, and I asked her, so would anybody put that on there who wasn't? Because just because it's on there does, you know. And she looked at me like I had five heads. She's like, why would they do that? I'm like, because people like to brag about things that aren't true. But she was quite confident that that's what that meant. I said, okay. This is another one of the Jewish cemeteries. And again, regardless if I could see the tombstones and the Hebrew that's on there, the density of these graves tell me that it is Jewish. This is just something that, I mean, you'll find some, actually more modern cemeteries that are dense because it's about getting as many people in as possible to make money. This is just a religious thing. The other thing about it is the bumpers, the grave rails, bed rails, whatever you want to call them around each grave, and the stones that are in the middle. In Judaism, you do not bring flowers to the grave site. You come, you take one of the pebbles that are in here, you say your prayers, and then you put them on top of the tombstones. So it shows that someone has been there. So I tell people when they're cleaning cemeteries, if you're seeing those pebbles on the top there, don't brush them off, because it's like flowers. I mean, it's a courtesy thing. So I love this cemetery. Again, there's eight of them right in the row, and then the last one I showed you is just across the street, and it's just really kind of an amazing thing. It's just really quite impressive. This is going to show an Orthodox religion, Greek Orthodox, Catholic Orthodox, something like that. That's just what their cross looks like. So looking at the symbol, they're still Christian, but they're of an Orthodox religion instead of, and that has to do with the split Catholic Church eons ago. Now this one, I never thought I had to know, well, what I thought was Arabic. So I'm in Park County, Indiana, which is kind of over by the Terre Haute area. And we are Judeo-Christian. We bury east-west. So we bury with our head facing west, our feet facing east, so that when Jesus comes again, you can sit up to greet him. And so pretty neat, orderly rows in Pioneer Cemetery. I can usually tell what's going on. So I'm in the cemetery doing my stuff, and they're all, and then in the back there are these three stones that are cockeyed. Because I'm nosy, I'm gonna go see what's going on. So I get down there and there are these three stones, and what I thought was Arabic, because I don't read it and it looks Arabic to me. And so I'm curious because this guy's in 1917. So I, you know, we do photographs to try to clear this up. I give it to everybody I can think of who could ever possibly have read Arabic. And everyone keeps telling me, I can't read this, I can't read this, until I find someone who also reads Farsi, which was the Persian government language in 1917 when this person died. So it's the language of Iran and Iraq. So we get to finally get the name of this guy on air, because I'm curious that not only he's in Park County, Indiana, in the middle of nowhere of Park County, Indiana, that he would come here, why was he here, that he could find a carver that could carve this. Because this is very different carving than carving English. And so I still don't know. I know that he came to work in the, he came here when was working in the clay tile industry, but I'm not sure why. The other two stones are so illegible that we can't read them. But I'm just fascinated that, you know, Indiana, it's just amazing kind of what you find when you start looking at tombstones. All right, so this one, for two reasons, tells me it's Catholic. One is the IHS. Now, I know in other religions, when you see the vestments of, like, your minister, it might have IHS on it, but on the tombstones, I only see it in Catholic cemeteries. I have no idea why, but it is just, it's a Catholic thing. The other thing is the short, stubby cross. I just notice it only in Catholic cemeteries. And so it just, again, tells me right away that that person is Catholic, which, again, might help if you're looking at your ancestor, might not. And then there's the rest of everybody else, all the rest of the Christian religions. I cannot tell a Methodist cemetery, unless the sign says St. Mark's Methodist Cemetery. Just by looking at the tombstones, you cannot tell whether it's Methodist or Baptist or Dunkard or anything else. just by the symbols. Because the symbols are symbols of the Bible and cross these groups no matter what. And so, again, looking at this and what the Bible, I've also seen it said as the Book of Life, but I can't tell, again, what that religious group is by that. Because what they're bringing in are symbols from the Bible as they're going across. So it helps to know your Bible. And if you're like me, you don't, there are some symbol books that will help and some things that help. And then also start looking in church windows, the stained glass windows, and even on things in the church, you're going to start seeing some of the same symbols both at the church and on the tombstone. So this one. Okay, maybe if you were on the East Coast or maybe up on Lake Michigan, you might think a sailor. But it comes from the religious, the Christ is the anchor of my religion. So you'll see lots of anchors, both in churches and on the tombstone for someone. Now, we all need an angel. We need an angel to get us up to heaven, to get our soul up to heaven. And then they also cross into a mourning angel. And so you'll see a lot of people calling them mourning angels, because what better way to have someone mourn your death forever is to put them on your tombstone. And I've got some great examples of that. So if you got somebody who doesn't have a lot of money who wants to do that, or you got somebody who's got some money and wants to do that, this angel taking a soul up to heaven. The interesting things about these large angels is to start looking at their faces, and they all look like the same woman because they were all carved by the same guy. This angel would not have been carved by your local carver. Your local carver would have ordered it from the Bedford, Indiana area. That's the predominant area, especially in Indiana, but this is one of the predominant areas in the United States where carving was happening. And these carvings were done in workshops or factories. And so, you know, if I'm a carver and I do the wings really well, that's all I do all day is wings. And the guy humming behind me is doing the face. So you start looking at the faces of these angels no matter where you are, you're like, oh, there she is again, and there she is again. The thing to start looking for are when the face changes, which means it's a new carver, or when the clothing style changes. Because the clothing style of the angel is going to change with some things that are popular in pop culture. And so she's kind of more angelic, where this morning angel is more Roman or Greek. And it has to do with the popularity in Roman and Greek stuff in the United States. And so she changes her clothes according to the pop culture. But if you saw her face head on, when I stood in front of her with head on, she's the same, just the same angel. And the hairstyle will change too. So the hairstyle changes again to what's popular in pop culture. So they're kind of nice. Now my poor husband, who I dragged to this thing because we're going to something afterwards, also gets drug into cemeteries when we travel. So I get some of these. What better way to mourn you? This is in Buenos Aires. But then to have her there on your casket at all times. And I've seen this also in Indiana, but I just think this is a great one. The next one is from Athens. And I think, convinced that the artwork in cemeteries is better than some of it you get in the art museums. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is marble, but that cloth looks soft. Mm-hmm. And it's just stunning. Now, the next one is when I told my husband, I want her on my tombstone. And he told me no. So I don't get her. She's from Rome. You go to the backside, and the feathers look like feathers. It's just really quite stunning. But he told me that he would have to die first, because if I die first, he's not putting her on my stone. And I told him I could arrange that. But, I mean, these mourning angels, again, she's going to mourn Emmeline's story for eternity. So I think they're fantastic. All right, so then you get the lamb. Lamb, usually, it has to do with Christ being the Lamb of God, and it usually symbolizes a child. Usually, 90% of the time. But every once in a while, you get some that are like, it's a lamb. You go over, and you look, and you're like, oh, she's 52. And I have an example. I was just in a cemetery last week, and I found an example it was a lamb, and she was 52. So I need to get the picture downloaded onto my computer and switch and add her in to show that usually it's a child, but not only. And so sometimes they're in like this, Sometimes they're on top. When they are on top, they do not weather well. So you will see them, they have lost their ears, any kind of definition about them because the acid rain has just eaten them away. And so if you look at it and you're like, is that a dog? What is that animal on there? It's probably a lamb that's just not survived very well. All right, so then as we start putting religious symbols, we also start moving into plants. And the plants and the flowers. And they, some of them come from religious symbols, but some of them have nothing to do with religion. And they come from this book, The Language of the Flowers. So Kate Greenaway in the 1800s went through poetry and the Bible and lots of other sources that we're not even sure about and wrote this book. And this is a book that all of us ladies would have had in our parlor. Because when I tell you I got red roses, what does that mean?
Love.
Why does it mean love? It's because we've all agreed it means love. I mean, why doesn't it mean death? They're bloody red. Why isn't it that? No, we have all agreed it means red roses. Because of, I mean, and part of it was like she would look at Shakespeare and things like that, but kind of brought it all together into one book. So I finally went on eBay and bought it so that I could see what, and yeah, you look at these and you're like, huh, okay, that's what that means. Or that's why that means it.
When was that?
I think it's 1880, but let me confirm the print date. 1884. So again, this is why we're putting, so the ivy means that, you know, it's everlasting, a love. It usually means couples, but it's for eternal love and eternal loyalty. And so that's what we're putting on there. And so you start getting plants and flowers on lots of tombstones. The other kinds of plants that you're putting on the tombstones come from the flowers that we're bringing to the funeral. Now, these funerals at these times were in your parlor. So someone dies, the family preps the body, puts a table out in the parlor, puts the casket out there, and you do a funeral there. Well, after about 3 days, you start to stink because you're rotting. And so one of the things that they did to cover up the smell of rot is they were bringing in flowers, very floral and fragrant flowers, some of the same flowers we send today. And so I think when you go into a funeral home, the smell of the flowers is overwhelming. It's because those flowers are no longer masking the odor of death. They're just there for, because that's the flower that you're supposed to send when someone dies. So we still send the same flowers. They're just not, they don't have the same cause, so the same reason to have them there. And some of those flowers are what we're putting on our caskets. Our tombstones. All right, we got then the weeping willow. Not only are we some of the trees and plants on the stones, but we're putting them in the cemetery also. And so this is a weeping willow. You can see the willow here. It's actually got a broken column, so you can see the column there, and it's broken. And that means like a life cut short. But so you start to see some of the plants in not only on the stone, but in the cemetery. So a weeping willow. So that tree will always mourn the people there. And the evergreen, because it's everlasting life. You get peonies and yuccas. If you've ever cleaned up a cemetery, you're going to find yuccas. I hate yuccas. You can't kill them to save your life. They're there to keep the soul in the ground. It's an old wives' tale. So they're there to make sure that the soul stays where it's supposed to be. And so you start getting some of these in on the tombstones also. And then another thing that you're going to start getting is harvested fruits and vegetables. So you get wheat, I've seen corn, I've seen apples. And it's just a life harvested, a soul harvested. Does not necessarily mean this person was a farmer, and doesn't necessarily mean it has anything to do with farming. It has to do with the harvested life, the harvested soul. All right, so this one, short stubby cross, so she's Catholic. But what I wanted to talk about this one is the photograph. This is a Catholic cemetery in Indianapolis, and as I'm walking through, I'm finding, and it's not just in this Catholic cemetery, but in cemeteries in general, the photographs, early on photographs, this doesn't relate to today, but early on photographs are only by people from Eastern Europe. I have no idea why. So I'm walking through the cemetery, the Catholics, none of the Catholics have pictures on there, none of the French have pictures on there, but she's Romanian. And so she is, that's why there's photos on there. And I just, it's what I've experienced, what I've noticed. I'm constantly looking. I'm going to be going to Chicago. The Indian Historical Society does a cemetery tour every year on their Step On Guide, and we're planning a trip to Chicago. And so we went into the Bohemian National Cemetery, and there are just boatloads of these pictures. They're just amazing everywhere. But when we went over to the Catholic cemetery, and that was the Irish Catholic, not a one. So I don't know why Eastern European. I've decided some intern someday needs to do their master's thesis on this and figure out why for me. Now, the pictures were made in Chicago, are still made in Chicago. The company still exists in Chicago. It's now a Toronto-owned company, but it's the same company owned in Chicago. So we get a lot of them in Indiana. They're ceramic, and they hold up really nicely as long as they're not vandalized. They hold up really nicely. Another group that I find uses them in the South. My dad's side of the family are from Mississippi, and so I was down there looking for photos, just hoping somebody might put it on there. But it was an African-American thing, not a white thing, and I don't know why, so I'm not sure what the reasoning is. Predominantly, you're going to get babies, soldiers, and brides. It just is the most common thing. Now, I have seen couples, I've seen old men and things like that, but the most prominent pictures you're going to see are babies, brides, and soldiers. The thing to look for is whether the person is alive or dead in the photo. Because sometimes, if they didn't have a photo of that person, they would take a picture of them in their casket and put it on there. Sometimes you can tell, that like they make it look like the person's sleeping, but sometimes it's like they tried to prop them up, and it's kind of creepy. But it's just really, it's quite interesting. So something to start looking for. All right, the handshaking. Couples. I was taking a group of reenactors on a tour through a cemetery for a conference. And I, pointed one out, and I said, it's a man and a woman, and it's a couple. And they said, well, of course it is. I said, okay, you've said that in a way that, what do you mean, of course it is? And they said, the cuffs, one is obviously a man's cuff and one is obviously a woman's cuff. And these are the type of people who get angry if someone's wearing an 1880s glasses in an 1879 reenactment. So they're those kind of people who care about the detail of historic costuming. And so we stopped doing my tour and we started going through the cemetery looking for just couples to see if it's true. And it held up. As they went to each of them, they said, oh yes, that's a man's cuff and that's a woman's cuff. The other thing they noticed is the cuffs changed according to the time period people died. So this is the cuff style for when this person died. So it's just interesting. It gives me another way to look at the stones. I would never have caught that because I am not a fashionista and historic costume is not my thing. So.
And another point for religious people in Europe, in the medieval times, if you ever see this sign, it's also their right hands holding, and that's always a sign for marriage, a sacred marriage.
Really?
It's
okay.
True.
Okay, there, see? Good, learn something every day. I'm going to spend more time in Europe. My husband is obviously failing me miserably. So what I will do now with this information is when I get over to Europe, I will do some serious paying attention to see, are they always the right hands, kind of stuff like that, so... All right, this is a pall, not like a Pauline, but so you have your funeral in your house. You have a table, over the table is a pall, and then there's a casket. And it was the pallbearer's job to make sure that the pall got to the cemetery or to the church, depending on where you were. Sometimes the palls were buried with people and sometimes they weren't. Today, a lot of churches still use them. The Catholic Church still has a pall, but it belongs to the church, not the family, and so it covers the casket, and then when you go to the funeral, to the grave site, the pall comes back to the church, which is where we get the word pallbearers from. You're no longer carrying the pall, you're carrying the casket. All right, so as we start moving in, just in society in general, in the 1800s, things are getting really gaudy and Victorian. So the clothing is thick, the materials are these dark and heavy things, everything is fancy-dancy, uber over the top, And there's a reaction to this called the Adirondack Movement. It's kind of going back to nature. And so you get a lot of rustic things. And in the tombstone world, it comes to the tree stump tombstone. This is a piece of limestone carved to look like a tree stump. It's not a tree stump. It's not a piece of wood at all. We have a state bird, we have a state tree, we have a state flower. I think we should have a state tombstone, and it should be the tree stump. Because these were made in Bedford. There were 7 shops, factories in Bedford, and then these guys would carve these up and send them to people all over, and I have found the world. I was in Japan in a Shinto cemetery. So this is the religion of the Japanese people, and I'm walking through taking pictures of stuff I don't understand because I don't speak Japanese at all, and there's a tree stump tombstone. So I had to take pictures of that. So everywhere you go, it's tree stump tombstone. So they would be carved up and shipped to your local carver, who would then carve in the information about the person. So a couple of things about it. I've had people tell me, and it's not true, but I've had people tell me that the number of limbs on the tree corresponds to the number of children that person has. And that is not true. And this stone right here can prove it more than anything, because she's an infant herself. She has no children. But simple genealogy on people has proven that that's not true. So don't take that as if you've got an ancestor who's got 8 of them, like, oh my God, I'm missing a child. I thought they only had 7. It's not related at all. And they run, again, they'll include some of the other symbols we're talking about. So tree stump, tombstone with the Bible. This next one has got a guy. You saw the anchor earlier. But they're still putting the symbols on the stone that they were putting on before during the Victorian period. It's just the mechanism to carry all these symbols is the tree stump. This next one I just recently came across, and I just love it. It is just, it's about 10 to 12 feet tall, and it's just full of stuff. And if you come closer to the chair, there's a chair on each side. So there's one here, and then there's one on the back side, and they say rest here. Notice the harvested crop. Mm-hmm. And they've got plants on it. I mean, just full of stuff, but just gorgeous. I love tree stump tombstones. They're amazing things. Should be our state tombstone. I would like to see the legislator willing to do that. All right. And then you get the people who are so devastated by someone's loss, they're going to put that person on their tombstone. So Corliss, this is in Crown Hill Cemetery. Corliss was 10 when he died, and his parents missed him so much, they had him, life size of him, on there. These were not cheap. So this is an impressive thing. And doesn't mean that these people were rich. So, I mean, just because you spent a lot of money on a tombstone does not correlate to that these people were rich. They just, again, missed them so much. This is in Bedford at a cemetery down there. There's a lot of life size in Bedford just because the stone carvers are there. This one's on a granite, which is really impressive because granite's a hard stone to carve. We call him the golfer. In the same cemetery, there's a doughboy. There is a miner. There's just amazing. There's a Christ that's life size. They're just really kind of quite impressive. So I love these. I've seen a picture of him, and you're like, yep, that's him. All right, so then we got our soldiers. Lots of ways that you're going to see someone being a soldier. This stone is a government-issued stone. So I can see the backside of it from 100 feet away and tell you that person is a vet. You go around to the front, the company K tells me that he is a Civil War vet. And the shape of it, if they're Civil War, the shape of this one tells me he's Union. The Confederate stones are at a point. They're just at a slight point. Does anyone know why? None of you have family from the South. My papa's from the South, so no damn Yankee ever sits on your stone. I don't know if that's why, but that's what I was always told as a child. So again, despite the government issues, this means it's a soldier. On this one here, this says GAR, Grand Army of the Republic. Our soldiers come back from Civil War and have post-traumatic stress. What they experienced there was horrific, and so coming back here, one of the things they looked for was camaraderie with their other soldiers. And so there wasn't anything like the VFW or the Legion, and so they created the Grand Army of the Republic as a way for soldiers to be together. And so GIR to me, even though, I mean, he also has that he's on there, the regiment, Indiana Volunteer, but just the GIR symbol tells me that he's a Civil War soldier. Now, poor Melinda, we don't know what year Melinda died because it's not been carved in. There are three potentials on this. One is Melinda remarried after Iram died, and she's buried with her second husband. Second is when she died, no one paid for the carver to come out and recarve it. She could not be buried there for reasons, or somebody tell me, well, maybe she's still alive. Well, it'd be impressive if she were, but no. So we don't know if she's buried there or not. And so without the cemetery records, you'll never know. So if you get something, even with Iram, I'm not 100% certain he's there. I assume he's there, but I am not 100% certain. Without the documented records from the cemetery, which are rare, especially in cemeteries this old, to have them, you're not sure that person's there or not. It could be what's called a cenotaph, and a cenotaph is a tombstone without a body. So you have, and sometimes you purposely have a cenotaph. It's in memorial of this person, that the person was killed overseas and don't have their body, and so this is that, but any tombstone, we assume they're there, but I'm not 100% certain, unless I have documentation that says that we can prove that they were buried there. Does that make sense? All right. So then our guys, what are you going to do on a Tuesday night in Indiana when there's no TV and there's no radio? You go to lodge. And we had a ton of lodges in this state. We were all lodge people. Some of them are still in existence today. This is the International Order of Odd Fellows, IOOF. Their mission, what they raised their funds for, was to bury widows and orphans. So you get a lot of IOOF cemeteries. So you get a lot of Odd Fellow cemeteries. There are 7 chapters of the IOOF still in existence in Indiana today. They have died off, no pun intended. But it's not popular anymore. And so there's one in Indianapolis. And every time I drive by their lodge, I just want to stop and knock on the door and see who's in there, because I'm fascinated with who would want to be an Odd Fellow. KFC is the Knights of Columbus. This is the Catholic version of the Masons. So if you see that on there, didn't know that your ancestor was a Mason or a Catholic. Probably the most common is Masons. And again, you'll see these not only in the tombstones, but in your downtown buildings, because that's where the lodge was. There are tons of these. There are offshoots of the Masons, like the Shriners. So you have lots of different groups that that your ancestor could have been part of. But maybe he was a TOTE. Anybody know what a tote is? I didn't either. And I'm like, where do I look for this? Well, there is a book out called Stories in Stone. It's a new book printed in the 2000s. And it's a book of symbolism. So the front part's all, you know, what this means and what the angel means. But what he has done in the back is an index of every lodge or fraternal organization or anything like that, so you can look it up. So if you get something like this, or you get a KP, and you're like, I don't know what that means. That's a Knights of Pythias. This is the Order of the Eagle, and it is an offshoot of the Red Men. And the Red Men were a fraternal lodge that everything, all of their symbols and all of their, what they wore to lodge was all Native American based. So they had headdresses and things like that. And so this is just an offshoot of it. So if you ever get something like this on there, if you get that Stories in Stone book and look at the back, he'll tell you, he's got to get an index. It's a nice thing to know, again, about your ancestor. All right, so then some other things start happening. We start to get popular in pop culture Greek and Roman stuff. And this is because of some things going on in the world. One of them is the professionalism of archaeology. And archaeologists start going around the world digging things up, and it starts getting published in the paper. And so your ancestor is, you know, living here in Rushville and gets out the evening paper, and there's a story about some archaeology find in Greece or Rome. And it becomes popular. And so people start taking this stuff and start putting on their tombstones. This person has no interest in the religion of it. And it doesn't mean they have any connection to it. It's just cool. And I have to agree that it's just cool. I mean, this is just an amazing thing. This is a sarcophagus. The person is not in here. They are in the ground on top of it. Historically, a sarcophagus, which means flesh eater in Greece, they are in that limestone casket because they thought it's limestone's caustic and it eats things away, and so they thought it ate the flesh away faster. But so this guy, again, no interest in Greek and Roman stuff, but it's pretty cool. So, and then the other thing that starts happening, or that happened, was Napoleon. Now Napoleon, when he is tramping across the world trying to convert everybody to being part of the French world, he also, along with his soldiers, took artists with him. And before his soldiers would bomb things and do target practice on things, the artists got a chance to draw it. These drawings then became available later, and then later in the 1820s and 30s and 40s, and started to get published in the papers. And so people here in Rushville might have seen the first time the pyramids or the Sphinx. And it fascinated people. This was really cool. They started getting into things like that and started putting things in their tombstone. These people have no interest in, again, the Egyptian gods. It's just cool. I have to agree. I love these kinds of things. Then something else starts happening is we're trying to figure out how are we going to celebrate and honor George Washington. First president, what are we going to do with it? We got to have something in D.C. And it takes from about the 1820s to the 1880s to get it figured out, fundraised, and built. Okay? And so people are seeing this all the time. And so a very Egyptian monument becomes the symbol of how we as Americans honor the great men in our communities. And I'm sure if I drove around in Rushville, I would find these tall obelisks, which, again, are very Egyptian. But this is how we as Americans have decided the important families in our community are going to be celebrated. And there's actually a book out called Characteristically American showing that transformation from, it just got published last year by Hoosier, she's a professor out of Fort Wayne, showing the change from Egypt and us, we took this on our own, and then, again, this is now an American symbol, even though it didn't start that way. All right, and we get the mausoleums. This mausoleum, the people could be in the walls, in the ground, they could be stacked up just in there, there's a variety of different ways they could be there. The interesting thing about mausoleums is to figure out how we're venting. I'm going to put you in a box and seal you up tight. If we don't vent your gas, because you're going to get gassy, it will explode. And so how they are venting the gas of decomposition, it just becomes a fun way when you're looking at these mausoleums. Now, this one doesn't have any glass in the front doors, so that's how they're venting it. But these down in New Orleans, this right here, pretty cross. No, it's hollow. Well, I mean, yes, it's a pretty cross, but it's hollow because that's how they're venting out. So you'll see stuff in the windows, stuff at the roof line, you'll see vents. And so it's just a matter of starting to look. And the vents are, again, for all of our gas we build up. And then we get the community mausoleums. Now, this was started by a company in Ohio, in northern Ohio. So these are very, very popular in northern Indiana. But this is Shelbyville. But this one right here, this is the Shelbyville Community Mausoleum. And these people started advertising, don't put your loved one in a cold, dark hole. Put them with other people in a community mausoleum. And so they would build these and sell the plots and then go on to the next community and start selling them. And I say plots, they're more of, this one's in Mexico, I like this one better. It's more decorated and they're photos again. But basically somebody purchases this space here, you take the cover off, you put the casket in there, you put the cover back on, which is then carved with the person's information, which is basically their tombstone, and that's what you get. So you get a lot of these in northern Indiana. But again, Shelbyville's not really northern Indiana. The problem becomes with these is ownership and care thereof. Because this one here in Shelbyville is in the city cemetery, but no one really seems to know who owns it, and it is a hot mess. It needs a lot of love, and so that has become the problem with these. All right, so then we move into today, and it is about us. We no longer, It's not about our religion. It's not about pop culture. It's about what we want people to know, remember about us. And so this gentleman wants you to know and remember that he owns the Colts. But it's not just the wealthy. I don't know the Henslers. I don't know who they are. But I know so much about them just by this. Now, we can do this for two reasons. One, we are using granite now. We moved from limestone and marble at the Depression. When the Depression hit, people went, we were going to have these big, even the tree stump tombstones, all these big monuments, and people could no longer afford it. And so we went to these small granite stones, and I say we never have never recovered from them. We have never gotten back to anything that's big and cool. So we're using, and granite was cheaper, so we're using granite. It is a very hard stone, so you can do things to it, like laser it. This is laser carved, so you put it in the computer, you can do drawings, you can actually now do color, and laser it on there, and tell you more about the Henslers than you wanted to know. We don't know how long this stuff will last. We don't know if it's going to be like the whetstones and it'll last forever, or is it going to be like the marble and fade away. So it'll be interesting to see as things go forward what that's going to mean. So going into the new part of the cemetery is kind of fun to see what people want people to think about them or know about them. All right, now some stuff I'm going to tell you has nothing to do with the family. It has to do with the stone carvers. Most of our stone carvers probably couldn't read. Actually, most of our ancestors probably couldn't read either. And you can't backspace. So when Sarah Ann Watson, W-A-T-S-O, and I forgot the space for the N, I'll put it up there. Typos are a beautiful thing to look for. Sarah Ann was born July 12th. Oh, forgot the TH. We're going to put it up there. Starting to look for these, because the stone carver didn't want to throw this away because it was money. And the family, if they even noticed, the family obviously accepted it. Did they even notice it? Because if they didn't read, then it may have been fine. So going through stones and looking for spacing issues. In my father's house, there are many mansions. I got so many issues with this. We got spelling issues. We got spacing issues. Oh, got a couple again with different cuffs. But again, why couldn't you put the M with... I don't know. I just think they're hysterical. So start looking for your typos. Because it's going to say, but it also is going to say something about your ancestor, because if they accepted that, they probably couldn't read. Mm-hmm. Which is an interesting thing, because I wouldn't accept that. Not today. I'd be like, yeah, I'd take that back and fix that. All right, so how are you going to know who your carver is? It's going to be in the bottom right-hand corner. He's going to sign it. Because if I'm going to go out and look at Grandma's grave, and I see the new stone put in there next to it, I'm like, oh, I like that. I wonder who did it. I look at the name. Well, most companies were. The gentleman who had the coffins was probably your local cabinet maker, local carpenter, because it makes sense that they would make these things. Eventually, they realized, oh, I can make cabinets and coffins, and if I had a stone carver on staff, so you'd get by your tombstone also from this company. And then you would know who to get it from. Now, many of these companies that were selling tombstones and caskets turned into funeral home directors. They'd actually do the burying for you. So your ancestor died, you'd have the funeral in your parlor, and then they would bury them for you. Well, the funeral home director wanted to take that out, wanted you to take out of your house that funeral. Because if you had the funeral in his place, he'd make some more money. And so they started lobbying. The funeral home directors started lobbying to get people to stop having funerals in their home. Because one of the things they were recommending is embalming. We perfected, I wouldn't say perfected, but got pretty close to perfecting embalming during the Civil War. Before the Civil War, there was not much embalming. There was not much of that because, again, you die at home, 3 days, you're in the ground. Well, your boy dies at Gettysburg. You want him home. Well, Gettysburg is the 4th of July weekend. It is hot, and what are we going to do with that body? Because if Mom wants him back in Indiana, we need to do something with it. And so they start perfecting that, pumping in the chemicals in to preserve you long enough for you to come home to be buried at home. So your funeral home director now no longer wants to just bury you. They want the funeral in their place, and they want to embalm you, all for the money. And so they start lobbying. And one of the groups they lobbied was Ladies Home Journal, which was a magazine that we all would have had, that we all would have read. And they convinced eventually Ladies Home Journal that funerals needed to be take place in the funeral homes. And in 1898, they Ladies Home Journal had an editorial that said, you need to take the funeral out of your home, take the death out of your home, and make that parlor into a living room. Which is why you no longer call it a parlor, you call it a living room. And that's all comes from that. So it's been really kind of an interesting, you know, there was no reason to have embalming or anything like that. It was just, it was a form of lobbying by the funeral home directors. All right, so this one is the American White Bronze Company. We call these stones white bronze or zinc. They are a metal stone. They are cast, and they have a lovely blue tint, like I do today in my shirt. So as you're looking across the cemetery, and if you see, like, you know, limestone and marble, and it's a lot of white, baby blue, that's a white bronze. It's a zinc. So they're metal. They're cast. They last really well if they're not vandalized. And when you go up to them and you tap on them, they're hollow. So they're not. It's not a solid piece of metal. They are light as can be. You can just pick them up like nothing. And so you can, you know, put the name in there. You'll see a lot of the symbols. Look, we got another cross there. You've got a pall. Same symbols in the other stones, but instead of being made out of a rock, it's made out of this cast metal. They were at. There was one in Chicago, one in Detroit, and one in Connecticut, were the main companies that made these. And so we do get a lot in Indiana. They advertise about being inexpensive, but who wants to be seen as cheap during their last times of their loved one? So they didn't go very well. I love them. I think they're my favorite. They last if they're left alone. And these pieces here, you just drill them out. A screw, and you could then switch out your panels if you wanted to. So, yeah, they're kind of fun. All right, Barbara Sue. Barbara Sue and I have the same sense of humor, and her children even said her humor lives on because her time's expired. And so is mine. So, what I hope I can do is that you just start looking differently at the stones. It's more than I use them too for death dates and birth dates and spellings and names and stuff like that. But what your ancestor put on there is important. And actually, it's not as important about the dead person, but their loved ones. Because they probably didn't buy the stone. It was their wife, husband, whatever, children. And it'll say a lot about them, about what they thought was important and what they wanted to remember always. Now, I have no more business cards. I'm going to grouse just for a second. I have to buy my own business cards now, and I am not intentionally buying business cards right now for some reasons about the office. So if you need to get a hold of me, please write it down. Or if you just call DNR and ask for the cemetery lady, everybody in DNR knows who I am. And you can get a hold of me if you've got questions, concerns about a cemetery, anything like that. Questions? Yes, sir.
Do you know where the term undertaker comes from?
I don't. Do you?
Yes. It started before actual embalming, and it was the person who undertook the process of building a casket, turning a tree into boards.
And he's an undertaker. There you go, see? There you go. You learn something new every day. I had never heard that, but that's a good one. I like that. So definitely as you travel, hit your cemeteries. My poor husband, we go all over the world, and I go to cemeteries.
What's the difference between a cemetery
I will have people back east, they tell me that a graveyard is attached to a church and a cemetery is not. In Indiana, I don't see a difference at all. They are, legally, there is no difference. Actually, legally, it's a burial ground. So, but the people back east tell me that a graveyard is attached to a church. But that's the way the East Coast people are. So I don't know. But legally in Indiana, there is no difference between the three. And under state law, they use the word burial ground. So I use them interchangeably between burial ground, cemetery, and graveyard. I mean, I think most, for me, I think a burial ground is something without headstones, just because, you know, we have Native American burial ground. And so if I'm talking to a group and we're talking about some place with tombstones, it's, to me it's a cemetery, we all know what we're talking about. But legally, there's no difference, so. Yes, sir?
The record for the churches who had a cemetery,
mm-hmm.
were the official records kept by the church or kept by the state?
Probably neither. It was not required by law to keep track of who was buried in the cemetery till 1939.
Wow.
Yeah. And so any church or any cemetery before 1939, it's going to be, it was in the sexton's head. The guy who was in charge of the cemetery, you know, said, yes, go ahead and bury someone there. Oh, no way, you can't bury someone in there. Joe's there and his wife's going next to him, so you're going to be put over here. And then when the sexton died, it all went away with him. And so before that, it's not required. After that, they're supposed to, but it wasn't enforced. And so that's a problem. So then when a church goes defunct, depending on what religion they're with, of whether they have a strong central governmental organization where their records are supposed to go to the that central agency, or they were just in grandma's attic, and then when grandma died, they got tossed. The state's not going to have them, though. The state won't have that.
The date, 1939, is that Indiana?
That's Indiana, yes. That is just Indiana. Other states, I don't even know if they still require it. I don't know when the dates are, but that isn't, that's the Indiana law. Yeah, I'm sorry, that should be clear. That this is Indiana laws and Indiana rules. And so if you have a plat map of a cemetery showing who bought the plats or the plots and who are in them, God, you're lucky, because most people just don't have them. Because it just wasn't required. Where you usually get them are when it's a corporation who owns the cemetery and they're keeping track because they want to get as many people in as tightly as possible to make as much money as possible. But when it's a religious group or an association where it's just people get buried, they're not going to be there. So
I'm looking for the town cemetery, which is here, it's the lower cemetery, and it was 1820,
okay,
which is going to be impossible. But where would I look?
Your biggest thing is going to be deed records. So you're going to have to, and if you're not sure exactly where, that's going to be tough, but it's going to be in the deeds showing that who owned. And when you say the town cemetery, in your mind it was probably owned by the town, but maybe not. It was just the cemetery that people in the town used. So one of your things is going to be looking for if to see if maybe Rushville actually owned it or not, but it could just be, so I would be start looking at early deeds. So Patton is where your person first purchases it or gets that land from the federal government. And then from there, then they sell it, and so then you have an index of buyers and sellers from that point. And so, but it's going to be a lot of work. It's not going to be easy, but it's literally, if you're not even sure where it is, it's going to be going through every deed book, looking for someone either talking about it in the deed, selling it and saying, I'm giving my property to the town or to this church for the town cemetery, and that's the only place it might be. But unfortunately, that's going to be, how strong is the archives of the Historical Society or the library? I'm not sure where they are here. So they may or may not have some early plat maps. I would look at the Indiana Historical Society. They have an amazing map collection and see if maybe they have some early ones. The state archives might have something if it has to do with a road going near it. So asking them for some early maps of the town, because as the early state roads are coming through here, maybe the surveyor, when he was drawing through the road's going to go here, might make a little comment that there was a cemetery over here. So that might be a good place to look. Unfortunately, yeah, especially if it's that early. How early are your newspapers?
1840s, 50s.
All right, so I don't know if you know this, but the State Library has a project now called Hoosier Chronicles. And they are scanning and by OCR, so searchable, every newspaper in the state. Now, they are, you know, there's a lot of newspapers, but they are starting with the earliest ones. And then they're also trying to go statewide. So they're trying to do, like, they're, you know, trying to do Lake County, Rush County, Posey County. They're not going to do all one county at once. And they're trying to start with the earliest stuff. So you might want to check there to see if that's and I would just put in like, and searching by a variety of names. So cemetery, burial, kind of all these kinds of things, and see if it comes up in the newspaper.
Where is that now?
Let me see if I can get online here. It's the State Library. It's called the Hoosier Chronicles. And if I can get online, I'll show you how it works. Let's see do you guys notice this has wireless here? Okay, they laugh, so that maybe not. If it works. If not,
I'm getting a little bit of a signal right now. Okay. We've had issues with that.
All right, www.in.gov/library. And that comes to the State Library's homepage. I think it's at the bottom, and it says Hoosier Chronicles. It's a big button that says Hoosier Chronicles. If you go into that, and then again, it's one of these things, you need to go back all the time, because the staff is working on this on a daily basis, scanning newspapers. So that could be a place. And then again, it's OCR-able, so it means it's word searchable. And so you could actually even put your ancestor's name in and see what pops up. There's another group called newspapers.com. Mm-hmm. They are pay to play. They're associated with ancestry.com. So if you have a full ancestry subscription, you can get the newspapers for free. And so I have found more about my husband's family than they really care for me to talk about in public. But because the Huntington County papers are in, I put in the last name Dinius, and man, all these things flying up about people being arrested. But newspapers.com should be another one you should look at. But they pay, the newspapers project through the State Library, two people at state government doing it as fast as they can do it, where newspapers.com, because it is a better pay rate, they got hundreds of people doing this. And so they're constantly, again, I'm always like, oh good, this county's up, oh good, this newspaper's up. So I use newspapers.com just because I think it's going to be faster just because, you're paying for it and stuff, so. That's about as best I can give you. So,
getting into early organizations of graveyards and cemeteries, in quote pioneer days, did they have to pay for a plot like that? Where did that come in?
Okay, so did yes. If early on, did you always have to pay for a plot? I'm gonna say it depends, and I think some of the depends is each a cemetery association may have required it just for some upkeep or to pay the sexton. Some churches may or may not have, required it as like a tithe to the church. But where you really get it is when you get corporations starting to be, you get the rural cemetery movement. And I don't mean rural like out in the middle of nowhere, but the rural cemetery movement were these organized landscape, professionally landscaped, professionally designed cemeteries like Crown Hill in Indianapolis. And you get these professionally, then these types of cemeteries are owned by corporations. They're no longer... It's about the money, and so we're going to design this thing beautifully, but then we're going to charge you for the beauty. And that's, I think, and so that starts about the 1840s, 1850s. Indiana, it hits the 1860s. It started on the East Coast, and by the time it got here, it's about the 1860s that the rural cemetery movement really kind of hits in Indiana. And again, then they start charging for to be in these pretty places, and it's the highest, place in the state or in the city. And it is just gorgeous. I think you guys have one in Rushville.
Mm-hmm. East Hill.
East Hill? Okay, so they are windy roads, and they've got the gatehouses and the beautiful gates. And so it's just not like a cemetery like this, which is, a nice little cemetery. And it's just, there's nothing formal about it. These are very formal landscape, and that's when they really start getting charged a plot fee.
Is there any database that's ever been attempted of family plots? Have they been lost to antiquity, or?
Again, my favorite answer to everything is depends. Some of these types of cemeteries, you will not have the family plots probably anywhere. The nicer cemeteries, the rural cemeteries, are going to have some good records, and they will have that in there. So like Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis has an online database of that, of theirs, but it's only Crown Hills.
But I was thinking more of the farmer... all the families buried in a plot on the back 40 some place.
Oh, now that's different. So if you're looking for just cemeteries in general, that's my office. That's my job. And we have an online database of all known cemeteries in the state.
Mm.
So whether it's a one person because it was the loved one and that's where the farmer put them, all the way to the largest ones, and we have that on our database. So if you go to DNR's database or DNR's website, and you can find the cemetery registry. It's a list of all known cemeteries in the state.
Okay.
So.
Relating to this question, we have a known, or at least on Ancestry.com, there's a Google map or whatever, a map that has a pinpoint with a GPS location in the middle of the farmer's field.
Okay.
Did somebody go there and know that exists and get that GPS location, or is that if somebody's guess?
Is it Find a Grave?
Well, we found it through Ancestry.com through a grave.
So I'm going to guess that one's a guess. Now, if you go to mine, which has not only a map but also the database, I actually have to go to every site and GPS it. So even in the farmer's field in the middle of it, I'm not putting it unless we know. So even if we know that historically there were some graves out there but we can't see them anymore, and so we don't know whether they're here or here, I won't pinpoint it. I'm going to bet if someone pinpointed there are no tombstones, they're a guessing. And that causes a lot of issues that could be a whole other talk. So that one I'm going to bet if there's not tombstones there for them to see through Google Maps, or like through the aerials, then they're just guessing.
Now, is your database different from this one of a few years ago that there's a 3-CD set of all the
That is the Indiana Genealogical Survey.
So yours is different.
Mine
than
is
that.
Different. Mine is more comprehensive, more complete, and updated. Where okay. the CDs been once, but mine is we find stuff. When we find the ones that are in the farmer's field and someone started digging for a home and it was like, oh, they're the bodies, we update it, and it's was constantly updated.
But you just have the location, but not necessarily any records for who might be buried
all right,
there.
Mine is not a find-a-grave, so mine does not say exactly who's buried in the cemetery, but it's locational.
Okay.
So, because it was mandated by the state legislature, and so it's about preserving the site, and so the size and the shape of the cemetery.
Okay.
And so, yeah, one day, not me, maybe they'll add on who's buried in every cemetery, but that's beyond me right now.
How do you get to your site?
On the DNR website.
Okay.
So.
Have you done Rush County?
I will not say all of Rush County, but I have a lot of Rush County in there. Because it literally takes me, I have to visit every site. And they don't let me just drop myself into Rush County for 5 months and never go back to my office. So I'll do a day in a county or in a couple of counties. I'll go all the way out to Metamora and take 52 all the way back and try to hit the cemeteries that are along there. And so on those types of days, I can usually get into 20 cemeteries a day and that's it. So it's going to take me a while. So I've got a lot of Rush County in there, so I would definitely encourage you to go in there to see what I've got. And I'm always looking for more and updated information. Because unfortunately, it's not the only thing I get to do in the office. And so there's other things I do, so it sits in my one of five things I do.
So I was thinking
give me an email. Yep, shoot me an email.
I was thinking one in particular that I did some work on several years ago, East Fork Cemetery.
I'd have to look up the database. There's 11,000 cemeteries in my database, and so I've stopped trying to memorize them because I'm getting them confused. So you would just go online and see what you can find.
Okay.
So, and I'll pull up the information, because you had a question back there, but it is in my, let's see, I think it's in here. It's in here. I have all my presentations here. Did you have a question?
Well, if we go to the pinpoint in the middle of the field and we do find a cemetery, should we notify you or
if
check
it's,
your database?
Check my database first. I mean, just because. You don't care about the password because this was for a presentation.
Wait a minute while I write that down.
Yeah, exactly. it's not.
Do we have to call that number if it is not in there?
I would prefer give me a holler because I'd rather because I want to get it in there. I mean, that's my big thing is I want to get it in there, so that way we know that way we've got it. Because my thing is that I want to. There is the URL, the in.gov/DNR/historic. But you can go, if you go on the DNR website and just put in cemeteries, it'll come up. And so what it looks like is that you get this page that you can search the registry. It's a little... Nope, that is about as clear as it's going to get. There you go. So you can put the name, the county and the township. So you can just put Rush County, and it'll give you every cemetery we have in Rush County. You hit the search button, and then it comes up with something like this. And so then it has all the cemeteries. You hit view, and then you can see there's photographs that are attached. If you hit view, it'll give you... Then there are these tabs, and each tab has different bits of information about the cemetery. So as I visit a cemetery, I'm looking for all the information that's in here and updating it then when I get back in the office. So there's geographic information. So that I'm getting an address. I'm getting a longitude and latitude, those UTM sites. I'm getting those for, and I'm doing not just one point. I'm doing 4 points or 5 points, the size of the cemetery and the shape of it. So that way, in 100 years, we'll still know the size and the shape of the cemetery. So we're doing that for every cemetery, looking at ethnic groups and number of stones and bibliographies and just more information about the cemetery. And then we're putting on photos and PDFs of it. So there'll be some current photos, maybe historic photos, deeds, kind of a variety of different things. Just each cemetery is different. So, and then there's also the Shard GIS, which is the mapping system. And so this is where you could go in and look for a cemetery. You can search that cemetery or search for cemeteries, and it'll bring you down to a point, and then you can see if it's mapped, I know exactly where it is. So the database, the Shard database, might have more cemeteries in it than are mapped, because there'll be some cemeteries where I have exact location unknown, and I can't map those. So I would definitely go on here and look at them and see what you can find. Got one more, and then I'll get you. Sorry, he had his hand up first.
How do they handle burials where there is no tombstone?
That one's a tough one, because you got to prove that it's a burial. If you told me you witched it and found it through witching, I'm going to say that's nice, but I can't put that on my cemetery registry because it's non-scientific. But there are some ways that we can prove that there's a grave there or not. So then the question comes is, where's the tombstone? One of the things we can do is we can probe to look for the tombstone, because the tombstone should be on the west end of the grave because of the way that we bury. And so if we can find it and put it back up, then that's where, because a lot of these stones are just tipped over and have gotten buried by dirt. But if there's no bear, if there's no tombstone there, to prove who that person is can be difficult. If in the 1940s, the DAR did a reading of that cemetery, and so you know just as it goes along that should be Joe, then that's Joe. But if it's like, we don't know who that is. I have another county, it is not this one, who the Historical Society wanted to dig up a grave to do DNA testing on a person. Well, it's not that simple. So let's just pretend we're going to dig someone up and do DNA testing. To do DNA testing, you have to destroy the body. You need a piece of the long bone. You need about this much of it. And we crush it up and pulverize it. So that's the first thing, is that you've got to be willing to desecrate the grave. Okay? So then you do that, and then you get DNA. Well, if you don't have it to compare to somebody, that DNA sample, all it's going to tell you, if it depending on the quality of the sample, it might tell you gender, it might tell you race. That's it. If I don't have anything to compare it to, it doesn't tell me anything. You would have to have a database of individuals. But let's pretend I know that that's my, I'm pretty sure that's my grandpa, my great-great-great-grandpa. So you can test it against me to tell me whether we are related familially. But all it will show is a family connection. It will not show me that is my great-great-great-grandpa. Because it could be an uncle. It could be a cousin. So all it shows me is family connection. But it doesn't even tell me which family. So if it's, you got a family that's been in the same county for generations, decades and eons. It could be my Regan side of the family, but it could be my St. Lawrence side of the family too. Because all it's going to tell me is family connection, that yes, you are related. Does that make sense? So DNA testing is not as fabulous as they show on TV. I mean, it's just, it's not. I mean, I watch some of these shows, even where it's like, you know, on the Discovery Channel, and they make these leaps and bounds that to me are just, just not true. Does that answer your question, or?
We praise grandparent or great-great-grandparent through, and that was called an inmate, but he lived in a poor place in the Depression.
Okay, yeah. So he was in a county home and or something like that, poorhouse.
They were buried at the foot of the grandparents with no tombstone. The only record that we found are with
the cemetery.
So the cemetery, but the cemetery says that he's there?
Right.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I would take that as good documentation.
But how do you folks handle that as far as putting it on an internet basis? Or
See, for me, not that your ancestor doesn't matter, but that doesn't matter to me, because whether there's one person there or 1,000. So if he's at the cemetery, I'm not going to add that there's one more person there, because all I care about is the size and the shape of the cemetery. Now, for that, but if you wanted to go to, like, find a grave, and you could add him on the find a grave listing without a problem. But I think that documentation there, I think, is pretty solid. So I would, if the cemetery says he was buried there on this date at the foot of the grandparents, I think that's good documentation. It's probably the best you're going to get. So you go to her and then back to them.
Okay. I'm just curious on what's happening at Crown Hill with the forest and the development they want to put in there.
I know about that much. So okay. So there's a Crown Hill has owned this property since the 1880s. They've owned it for a long time because they realized that Butler University was coming this way, and so they bought more property in order in case they ever need to expand. It's been farmed for quite a long time. I can tell you in the 1930s in the aerials, we can see farmland there and not trees. Yes, in order to date a tree, you do it by counting rings. So how do you count rings?
Cut the tree down.
You cut that tree down or you core it, and you core it so much that it kills it. So these people who are telling everyone that these are 500-year-old trees, DNR sitting there going, do that. Because if they've got a new technique that we don't know, and again, this is me getting people from Division of Forestry who are telling me this. I mean, DNR doesn't have a stand on this one where, you know, if people want to save the trees, save the trees. But don't lie and say that they are 500-year-old trees when we can't prove it. Now, I have been told that Crown Hill has agreed to save the 11 oldest trees, and they're not the 11 oldest, they're the 11 biggest trees. Oh. That's what they're going to be saving. Because we, again, without coring, you don't know how old a tree is. So they're going to save the 11 oldest trees and still allow, it's going to be a columbarium, which is where you bury cremains, and it's going to be a columbarium for vets. It's the VA hospital, or the VA administration who is doing this. So they're going to build the columbarium, but the 11 oldest tree or the biggest trees will still be saved. So yeah, it is one of these things that, yeah, it is. I am a person who, I don't care what the results are, but make sure you are given the facts. Mm-hmm. And that one, I'm going to...
Stretching it a bit,
so...
A little bit of information. You can measure the diameter of a tree and go to that species, and it gives you a relative age because of growth rate on average of a certain species.
Right. And DNR has those because we Division of Forestry, but I also can tell you in the 1930s I can see farmland there.
Yeah.
So they're just
I'm not
just
saying they're 500 years old, but one species of tree can be huge and be younger than another tree is smaller.
Exactly. And so there's a lot of issues with that one. Yes.
Getting back to the unmarked grave issue, I've done some work with the Raleigh Cemetery, and in their records, there's a notation that, well, a child or an infant is buried in the walkway between something or other.
Yes.
There's no stone there. I've walked the cemetery.
Yeah, and there's no stone.
The only record of it is in the plot sales that somebody either had one adjacent or there wasn't even any burial spot. It's just, well, there was a burial
there's
in
space
the walkway.
There. Well, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, Yes, and unfortunately we get those. We get a lot of those. Sometimes, especially when it's someone who didn't have any money, so a pauper.
Yeah.
That was just a nice way that gave someone.
Well, these were I think all of them were children, so.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Oh, not a problem.
Very good.
We're heading up north up to Huntington. We're celebrating on Monday's our anniversary, so we're going up to Joseph DeQuay, which is fancy restaurant, and see his parents.
I want to thank everyone else for coming today. Nice to meet
We're gonna start heading now, but thank you.
Close it. You still have to unlock it and get up here to the nail start.
Yeah.